The path which led up to the kitchen door of Myra Evans's house was lined with rocks painted in various pastel colors. Cora Rusk picked up a blue one and bounced it in the hand which was not holding her gun, testing its weight. She tried the door. It was locked, as she had expected. She tossed the rock through the glass and used the barrel of her pistol to clear away the shards and splinters still clinging to the frame. Then she reached through, unlocked the door, and stepped inside. Her hair clung to her cheeks in wet snaggles and commas. Her dress still gaped open, and droplets of rainwater ran down the pimple-studded swells of her breasts. Chuck Evans wasn't home, but Garfield, Chuck and Myra's Angora cat, was. He came trotting into the kitchen, meowing, hoping for food, and Cora let him have it. The cat flew backward in a cloud of blood and fur. "Eat that, Garfield," Cora remarked. She strode through the puff of gun smoke and into the hall. She started up the stairs. She knew where she would find the slut. She would find her in bed. Cora knew that as well as she knew her own name. "It's bedtime, all right," she said. "You just want to believe it, Myra, my dear." Cora was smiling. Father Brigham and Albert Gendron led a platoon of pissed-off Catholics down Castle Avenue toward Harrington Street. Halfway there, they heard singing. The two men exchanged a glance. "Do you think we might be able to teach him a different tune, Albert?" Father Brigham asked softly. "I think so, Father," Albert replied. "Shall we teach them to sing, 'I Ran All the Way Home'?" "A very good tune, Father. I think maybe even muck like them might be able to learn that one." Lightning flew across the sky. It illuminated Castle Avenue with momentary brilliance and showed the two men a small crowd advancing up the hill toward them. Their eyes gleamed white and empty like the eyes of statues in the lightning flash. "There they are," someone shouted, and a woman cried, "Get the dirty Mickey Finn sons of bitches." "Let's bag some trash," Father John Brigham breathed happily and charged the Baptists. "Amen, Father," Albert said, running at his side. They all began to run then. As Trooper Morris rounded the corner, a fresh bolt of lightning jigged across the sky, felling one of the old elms by Castle Stream. In the glare, he saw two mobs of people running toward each other. One mob was running up the hill, the other mob was running down, and both mobs were screaming for blood. Trooper Morris suddenly found himself wishing he had called in sick that afternoon. Cora opened the door of Chuck and Myra's bedroom and saw exactly what she had expected, the bitch lying naked in a rumpled double bed which looked as if it had seen a hard tour of duty lately. One of her hands was behind her, tucked under the pillows. The other held a framed picture. The picture was between Myra's meaty thighs. She appeared to be humping it. Her eyes were half closed in ecstasy. "Oh, ee," she moaned. "Oh, ee. Oh, ee." Horrified jealousy flared in Cora's heart and rose up her throat until she could taste its bitter juice in her mouth. "Oh, you shithouse mouse," she breathed and brought up the automatic. At that moment, Myra looked at her, and Myra was smiling. She brought her free hand out from under the pillow. In it, she held an automatic pistol of her own. "Mr. Gaunt said you'd come, Cora," she said, and fired. Cora felt the bullet beat the air beside her cheek, heard it thud into the plaster on the left side of the door. She fired her own gun. It struck the picture between Myra's legs, shattering the glass and burying itself in Myra's upper thigh. It also left a bullet hole in the center of Elvis Presley's forehead. "Look what you did!" Myra shrieked. "You shot the king, you stupid cunt!" She fired three shots at Cora. Two went wild, but the third hit Cora in the throat, driving her backward against the wall in a pink spray of blood. As Cora collapsed to her knees, she fired again. The bullet punched a hole in Myra's kneecap and knocked her out of bed. Then Cora fell face forward onto the floor, the gun slipping from her hand. "I'm coming to you, Elvis," she tried to say, but something was terribly, terribly wrong. There seemed to be only darkness, and no one in it but her. Castle Rock's Baptists, led by the Reverend William Rose, and Castle Rock's Catholics, led by Father John Brigham, came together near the foot of Castle Hill with an almost audible crunch. There was no polite fist-fighting, no Marquis of Queensbury rules. They had come to gouge out eyes and tear off noses, quite possibly to kill. Albert Gendron, the huge dentist who was slow to anger but terrible once his wrath was roused, grabbed Norman Harper by the ears and jerked Norman's head forward. He brought his own head forward at the same time. Their skulls crashed together with a sound like crockery in an earthquake. Norman shuddered, then went limp. Albert threw him aside like a bag of laundry and grabbed for Bill Sayers, who sold tools at the Western Auto. Bill dodged, then threw a punch. Albert took it squarely on the mouth, spat a tooth, grabbed Bill in a bear hug, and squeezed until he heard a rib snap. Bill began to shriek. Albert threw him most of the way across the street, where Trooper Morris stopped just in time to avoid running him down. The area was now a tangle of struggling, punching, gouging, yelling figures. They tripped each other. They slipped in the rain. They got up again. They hit out and were hit in return. The gaudy splashes of lightning made it seem that some weird dance was going on, one where you threw your partner into the nearest tree instead of allemanding her, or dug your knee into his crotch instead of doing a do-si-do. Nan Roberts grabbed Betsy Vigue by the back of the dress as Betsy tore tattoos into Lucille Dunham's cheeks with her nails. Nan yanked Betsy toward her, whirled her around, and poked two of her fingers up Betsy's nose all the way to the second knuckles. Betsy uttered a nasal foghorn screech as Nan began to shake her enthusiastically back and forth by her nose. Frida Pulaski belted Nan with her pocketbook. Nan was driven to her knees. Her fingers came out of Betsy Vigue's nose with an audible pop. When she tried to get up, Betsy kicked her in the face and knocked her sprawling in the middle of the street.
"You bitch! You wrecked my nose!" Betsy shrieked. "You wrecked my nose!"
She tried to stamp her foot down into Nan's belly. Nan grabbed her foot, twisted her, and dumped the once-upon-a-time Betty Lala face first into the street. Nan crawled to her. Betsy was waiting. A moment later, they were rolling over and over in the street, biting and scratching. "Stop!" Trooper Morris bellowed, but his voice was drowned out in a volley of thunder which shook the entire street. He pulled his gun, raised it skyward, but before he could fire, someone, God only knows who, shot him in the crotch with one of Leland Gaunt's special sale items. Trooper Morris flew backward against the hood of his cruiser and rolled into the street, clutching the ruins of his sexual equipment and trying to scream. It was impossible to tell just how many of the combatants had brought weapons purchased from Mr. Gaunt that day. Not many, and some of those who had been armed had lost the automatics in the confusion of trying to escape the stink bombs. But at least four more shots were fired in rapid succession, shots that were largely overlooked in the confusion of shouting voices and booming thunder. Len Milliken saw Jake Pulaski aiming one of the guns at Nan, who had allowed Betsy to get away and was now trying to choke Meade Rossignol. Len grabbed Jake's wrist and forced it upward into the lightning-dazzled sky a second before the gun went off. Then he brought Jake's wrist down and snapped it over his knee like a stick of kindling wood. The gun clattered onto the wet street. Jake began to howl. Len stepped back and said, "That'll teach you to..." He got no further, for someone chose that moment to sink the blade of a pocket knife into the nape of his neck, severing Len's spinal cord at the brainstem. Other police cars were arriving now, their blue lights swinging crazily in the rain-swept dark. The combatants did not heed the amplified yells to cease and desist. When the troopers attempted to break things up, they found themselves sucked into the brawl instead. Nan Roberts saw Father Brigham, his damned black shirt split right up the back. He was holding Reverend Rose by the nape of the neck with one hand. His other hand was rolled up into a tight fist, and he was popping Reverend Rose repeatedly in the nose with it. His fist would slam home, the hand holding the nape of Reverend Rose's neck would rock backward a little, and then it would haul Reverend Rose back into position for the next blow. Bellowing at the top of her lungs, ignoring the confused state trooper who was telling her, almost begging her, to stop and stop right now, Nan slung away Meade Rossignol and launched herself at Father Brigham.
The
The onslaught of the storm slowed Alan down to a crawl in spite of his growing feeling that time had become vitally, bitterly important, and that if he didn't get back to Castle Rock soon, he might just as well stay away forever. Much of the information he had really needed, it seemed to him now, had been in his mind all along, locked up behind a stout door. The door had a legend printed neatly on it, but not Office of the President, or Boardroom, or even Private, Do Not Enter. The legend printed on the door in Alan's mind had been, "This makes no sense." All he'd needed to unlock it was the right key, the key which Sean Rusk had given him. And what was behind the door? Why, Needful Things, and its proprietor, Mr. Leland Gaunt. Brian Rusk had bought a baseball card in Needful Things, and Brian was dead. Nettie Cobb had bought a lampshade in Needful Things, and she was dead, too. How many others in Castle Rock had gone to the well and bought poisoned water from the poisoned man? Norris had a fishing rod. Polly had a magic charm. Brian Rusk's mother had a pair of cheap sunglasses that had something to do with Elvis Presley. Even Ace Merrill had an old book. Alan was willing to bet that Hugh Priest had also made a purchase, and Danforth Keaton. How many others? How many? He pulled up on the far side of the tin bridge just as a bolt of lightning struck down from the sky and severed one of the old elms on the other side of Castle Stream. There was a huge electrical crackle and a wild streak of brilliance. Alan threw an arm across his eyes, but an afterimage was still printed on them in stark blue as the radio uttered a loud blurt of static and the elm toppled with ponderous grandeur into the stream. He dropped his arm, then yelled as thunder bellowed directly overhead, sounding loud enough to crack the world. For a moment, his dazzled eyes could make out nothing, and he was afraid the tree might have fallen on the bridge, blocking his way into town. Then he saw it lying just upstream of the rusty old structure, buried in a loom of rapids. Alan put the cruiser in gear and made the crossing. As he did, he could hear the wind, which was now blowing a gale, hooting in the struts and girders of the bridge. It was a creepy, lonely sound. Rain pelted against the old station wagon's windshield, turning everything beyond it into a wavering hallucination. As Alan came off the bridge and onto Lower Main Street, at its intersection with Watermill Lane, the rain began to come so hard that the wipers, even on fast speed, were entirely useless. He unrolled his window, stuck his head out, and drove that way. He was instantly soaked. The area around the municipal building was loaded with police cars and news vans, but it also had a weird, deserted look, as if the people who belonged to all these vehicles had suddenly been teleported to the planet Neptune by evil aliens. Alan saw a few news people peering out from the shelter of their vans, and one state cop ran down the alley, which led to the municipal building's parking lot, rainwater spatting up from his shoes, but that was all. 3 blocks up toward Castle Hill, an SP cruiser shot across Upper Main at high speed, heading west along Laurel Street. A moment later, another cruiser shot across Main. This one was on Birch Street and headed in the opposite direction from the first. It happened so fast, zip, zip, that it was like something you'd see in a comedy movie about bumbling police, Smokey and the Bandit, perhaps. Alan, however, saw nothing funny in it. It gave him a sense of action without purpose, a kind of panicky, helter-skelter movement. He was suddenly sure that Henry Peyton had lost control of whatever was happening in Castle Rock tonight, if he'd ever had anything more than an illusion of control in the first place, that was. He thought he could hear faint cries coming from the direction of Castle Hill. With the rain, thunder, and driving wind, it was hard to tell for sure, but he did not think those cries were just imagination. As if to prove this, a state police car roared out of the alley next to the municipal building, flashing headlights and whirling dome lights, illuminating silvery streaks of rain, and headed in that direction. It nearly sideswiped an oversized WMTW news wagon in the process. Alan remembered feeling earlier this week that there was something badly out of joint in his little town, that things he could not see were going wrong, and Castle Rock was trembling on the edge of some unthinkable disorder. And now the disorder had come, and it had all been planned by the man. Brian said Mr. Gaunt wasn't really a man at all. Alan had never quite managed to see. A scream rose in the night, high and drilling. It was followed by the sound of shattering glass, and then, from somewhere else, a gunshot and a burst of cracked, idiot laughter. Thunder banged in the sky like a pile of dropped boards. But I have time now, Alan thought. Yes. plenty of time. Mr. Gaunt, I think we ought to say hello to each other, and I think it's high time you found out what happens to people who fuck with my town. Ignoring the faint sounds of chaos and violence he heard through his open window, ignoring the municipal building where Henry Peyton was presumably coordinating the forces of law and order, or trying to, Alan drove up Main Street toward Needful Things. As he did, a violent white-purple bolt of lightning flared across the sky like an electric fire tree, and while the accompanying cannonade of thunder was still roaring overhead, all the lights in Castle Rock went out. Deputy Norris Ridgewick, clad in the uniform he kept for parades and other dress occasions, was in the shed attached to the little house he had shared with his mother until she died of a stroke in the fall of 1986, the house where he had lived alone since then. He was standing on a stool. A heavy length of noosed rope hung down from one of the overhead beams. Norris ran his head into this noose and was pulling it tight against his right ear when lightning flashed and the two electric bulbs which lit the shed winked out. Still, he could see the basin fishing rod leaning against the wall by the door which led into the kitchen. He had wanted that fishing rod so badly and had believed he had gotten it so cheaply, but in the end the price had been high. Too high for Norris to pay. His house was on the upper arm of Watermill Lane, where the lane hooks back toward Castle Hill and the view. The wind was right, and he could hear the sounds of the brawl which was still going on there, the screams, the yells, the occasional gunshot. I'm responsible for that, he thought. Not completely, hell no, but I'm a part of it. I participated. I'm the reason Henry Beaufort is hurt or dying, maybe even dead over in Oxford. I'm the reason Hugh Priest is on a cooling board. Me, the fellow who always wanted to be a policeman and help folks, the fellow who wanted that ever since he was a kid, stupid, funny, clumsy old Norris Ridgewick, who thought he needed a basin fishing rod and could get one cheap. I'm sorry for what I did, Norris said. That doesn't fix it, but for whatever it's worth, I'm real sorry. He prepared to jump off the stool, and suddenly a new voice spoke up inside his head. Then why don't you try to put it right, you chicken shit coward? I can't, Norris said. Lightning blazed, his shadow jumped crazily on the shed wall, as if he were already doing the air dance. It's too late. Then at least take a look at what you did it for, the angry voice insisted. You can do that much, can't you? Take a look. Take a really good look. The lightning flashed again. Norris stared at the basin rod and let out a scream of agony and disbelief. He jerked, almost tumbling off the stool and hanging himself by accident. The sleek basin, so limber and strong, was no longer there. It had been replaced by a dirty, splintery bamboo pole, really no more than a stick with a kid's Zebco reel attached to it by one rusty screw. "Someone stole it!" Norris cried. All his bitter jealousy and paranoid covetousness returned in a flash, and he felt that he must rush out into the streets and find the thief. He must kill them all, everyone in town, if that was necessary, to get the evil man or woman responsible. "Someone stole my basin!" he wailed again, swaying on the stool. "No," the angry voice replied. "This is how it always was. All that's been stolen is your blinders, the ones you put on yourself. Of your own free will."
No!
Monstrous hands seemed to be clapped against the sides of Norris's head. Now they began to squeeze.
No, no, no!
But the lightning flashed, again showing him the dirty bamboo rod where the basin had been only moments before. He had put it there so it would be the last thing he ever saw when he stepped off the stool. No one had been in here. No one had moved it. Consequently, the voice had to be right. "This is how it always was," the angry voice insisted. "The only question is this. Are you going to do something about it, or are you going to run away into the darkness?" He began to grope for the noose, and at that moment he sensed he was not alone in the shed. In that moment he seemed to smell tobacco and coffee and some faint cologne, southern gentleman, perhaps, the smells of Mr. Gaunt. Either he lost his balance or angry, invisible hands pushed him from the stool. One foot clipped it as he swayed outward and knocked it over. Norris's shout was choked off as the slipknot pulled tight. One flailing hand found the overhead beam and caught it. He yanked himself partway up, providing himself with some slack. His other hand clawed at the noose. He could feel hemp prickling at his throat. "No is right," he heard Mr. Gaunt cry out angrily. "No is exactly right, you damned Welsher." He wasn't here, not really. Norris knew he hadn't been pushed. Yet he felt a complete certainty that part of Mr. Gaunt was here just the same. And Mr. Gaunt was not pleased, because this was not the way it was supposed to go. The suckers were supposed to see nothing, not at least until it was too late to matter. He yanked and clawed at the noose, but it was as if the slipknot had been dipped in concrete. The arm which was holding him up trembled wildly. His feet scissored back and forth 3 feet above the floor. He could not hold this half chin up much longer. It was amazing he had been able to keep any slack in the rope at all. At last, he managed to wiggle two of his fingers under the noose and pull it partway open. He shook his head out of it just as a horrible, numbing cramp struck the arm which was holding him up. He toppled to the floor in a sobbing heap, holding his cramped arm to his chest. Lightning flew and turned the spit on his bared teeth into tiny purple arcs of light. He grayed out then. For how long, he didn't know, but the rain was still pelting and the lightning was still flashing when his mind swam back into itself. He staggered to his feet and walked over to the fishing pole, still holding his arm. The cramp was beginning to loosen now, but Norris was still panting. He seized the pole and examined it closely and angrily. Bamboo. Dirty, filthy bamboo. It wasn't worth everything. It was worth nothing. Norris's thin chest hitched in breath, and he uttered a scream of shame and rage. At the same moment, he raised his knee and snapped the fishing rod over it. He doubled the pieces and snapped them again. They felt nasty, almost germy, in his hands. They felt fraudulent. He cast them aside, and they rattled to a stop by the overturned stool like so many meaningless pickup sticks. "There!" he cried. "There! There! There!" Norris's thoughts turned to Mr. Gaunt. Mr. Gaunt, with his silver hair and his tweed and his hungry, jostling smile. "I'm going to get you," Norris Ridgwick whispered. "I don't know what happens after that, but I am going to get you so good." He walked to the shed door, yanked it open, and stepped out into the pouring rain. Unit 2 was parked in the driveway. He bent his thin, Barney Fife body into the wind and walked over to it. "I don't know what you are," Norris said, "but I'm coming for your lying, conning ass." He got into the cruiser and backed down the driveway. Humiliation, misery, and anger were equally at war on his face. At the foot of the driveway, he turned left and began driving toward Needful Things as fast as he dared. Polly Chalmers was dreaming. In her dream, she was walking into Needful Things, but the figure behind the counter was not Leland Gaunt. It was Aunt Evie Chalmers. Aunt Evie was wearing her best blue dress and her blue shawl, the one with the red edging. Gripped between her large and improbably even false teeth was a Herbert Terryden. "Aunt Evie!" Polly cried in her dream. A vast delight and an even vaster relief, the relief we know only in happy dreams and in the moment of waking from horrid ones, filled her like light. "Aunt Evie, you're alive!" But Aunt Evie showed no sign of recognition. "Buy anything you want, miss," Aunt Evie said. "By the way, was your name Polly or Patricia? I disremember somehow." "Aunt Evie, you know my name. I'm Tricia. I've always been Tricia to you." Aunt Evie took no notice. "Whatever your name is, we're having a special today. Everything must go." "Aunt Evie, what are you doing here?" "I belong here," Aunt Evie said. "Everyone in town belongs here, Miss Two Names. In fact, everyone in the world belongs here, because everyone loves a bargain. Everyone loves something for nothing, even if it costs everything." The good feeling was suddenly gone. Dread replaced it. Polly looked into the glass cases and saw bottles of dark fluid marked Dr. Gaunt's Electric Tonic. There were badly made wind-up toys that would cough up their cogs and spit out their springs the second time they were wound. There were crude sex toys. There were small bottles of what looked like cocaine. These were labeled Dr. Gaunt's Kickapoo Potency Powder. Cheap novelties abounded. Plastic dog puke, itching powder, cigarette loads, joy buzzers. There was a pair of those X-ray glasses that were supposed to allow you to look through closed doors and ladies' dresses, but actually did nothing except put raccoon rings around your eyes. There were plastic flowers and marked playing cards and bottles of cheap perfume marked Dr. Gaunt's Love Potion Number 9 Turns Lassitude into Lust. The cases were a catalog of the timeless, the tasteless, and the useless. "Anything you want, Miss Two Names," Aunt Evie said. "Why are you calling me that, Aunt Evie? Please, don't you recognize me?" "It's all guaranteed to work. The only thing not guaranteed to work after the sale is you. So step right up and bye, bye, bye." Now she looked directly at Polly, and Polly was struck through with terror like a knife. She saw compassion in Aunt Evie's eyes, but it was a terrible, merciless compassion. "What is your name, child? Seems to me I once knew." In her dream, and in her bed, Polly began to weep. "Has someone else forgotten your name?" Aunt Evie asked. "I wonder. Seems like they have." "Aunt Evie, you're scaring me." "You're scaring yourself, child," Aunt Evie responded, looking directly at Polly for the first time. "Just remember that when you buy here, Miss Two Names, you're also selling."
"But I need it," Polly cried. She began to weep harder. "My hands!"
"Yes, this does it, Miss Polly Frisco," Aunt Evie said, and brought out one of the bottles marked Dr. Gaunt's Electric Tonic. She set it on the counter, a small, squat bottle filled with something that looked like loose mud. "It can't make your pain gone, of course. Nothing can do that. But it can affect a transferal."
"What do you mean? Why are you scaring me?"
"It changes the location of your arthritis, Miss Two Names. Instead of your hands, the disease attacks your heart."
"No."
"Yes."
"No, no, no."
"Yes. Oh, yes. And your soul as well. But you'll have your pride. That'll be left to you, at least. And isn't a woman entitled to her pride? When everything else is gone, heart, soul, even the man you love, you'll have that, little Miss Polly Frisco, won't you? You'll have that one coin without which your purse would be empty. Let it be your dark and bitter comfort for the rest of your life. Let it serve. It must serve. Because if you keep on the way you're going, there surely won't be no other."
"Stop. Please, can't you?"
"Stop," she muttered in her sleep. "Please stop. Please." She rolled over on her side. The Ozka chinked softly against its chain. Lightning lit up the sky, striking the elm by Castle Stream, toppling it into the rushing water as Alan Pangborn sat behind the wheel of his station wagon, dazzled by the flash. The follow-shot crack of thunder woke Polly up. Her eyes flew open. Her hand went to the Ozka at once and closed protectively around it. The hand was limber. The joints moved as easily as ball bearings packed in deep, clean oil. "Miss Two Names. Little Miss Polly Frisco." "What?" Her voice was thick, but her mind already felt clear and alert, as if she hadn't been asleep at all, but in a daze of thought so deep it was nearly a trance. Something was looming in her mind, something the size of a whale. Outside, lightning flashed and flickered across the sky like bright purple sparklers. "Has someone else forgotten your name? Seems like they have." She reached for the night table and switched on the lamp. Lying next to the princess phone, the phone equipped with the oversized keypads which she no longer needed, was the envelope she had found lying in the hall with the rest of the mail when she returned home this afternoon. She had refolded the terrible letter and slid it back inside. Somewhere in the night, between the racketing bursts of thunder, she thought she could hear people shouting. Polly ignored them. She was thinking about the cuckoo bird, which lays its egg in a strange nest while the owner is away. When the mother-to-be returns, does she notice that something new has been added? Of course not. She simply accepts it as her own. The way Polly had accepted this goddamned letter simply because it happened to be lying on the hall floor with two catalogs and a come-on from Western Maine Cable TV. She had just accepted it, but anyone could drop a letter through a mail slot. Wasn't that true? "Miss Two Names," she murmured in a dismayed voice. "Little Miss Polly Frisco." And that was the thing, wasn't it? The thing her subconscious had remembered and had manufactured Aunt Evie to tell her. She had been Miss Polly Frisco. Once upon a time, she had. She reached for the envelope. No, a voice told her, and that was a voice she knew very well. Don't touch that, Polly. Not if you know what's good for you. Pain as dark and strong as day-old coffee flared deep in her hands. It can't make your pain gone, but it can affect a transferal. That whale-sized thing was coming to the surface. Mr. Gaunt's voice couldn't stop it. Nothing could stop it. You can stop it, Polly, Mr. Gaunt said. Believe me, you must. Her hand drew back before it touched the letter. It returned to the Oscar and became a protective fist around it. She could feel something inside it, something which had been warmed by her heat, scurrying frantically inside the hollow silver amulet, and revulsion filled her, making her stomach feel weak and loose, her bowels rotten. She let go and reached for the letter again. Last warning, Polly, the voice of Mr. Gaunt told her. Yes, Aunt Evie's voice replied. I think he means it, Tricia. He has always so enjoyed ladies who take pride in themselves, but do you know what? I don't think he's got much use for those who decide it goeth before a fall. I think the time has come for you to decide once and for all what your name really is. She took hold of the envelope, ignoring another warning twinge in her hands, and looked at the neatly typed address. This letter, purported Xerox, had been sent to Ms. Patricia Chalmers. No, she whispered, wrong. Wrong name. Her hand closed slowly and steadily on the letter, crumpling it. A dull ache filled her fist, but Polly ignored it. Her eyes were bright, feverish. I was always Polly in San Francisco. I was Polly to everyone, even to child welfare. That had been part of her attempt to break clean with every aspect of the old life, which she fancied had hurt her so badly. Never in her darkest nights allowing herself to dream that most of the wounds had been self-inflicted. In San Francisco there had been no Tricia or Patricia, only Polly. She had filled out all three of her ADC applications that way and had signed her name that way, as Polly Chalmers, no middle initial. If Alan really had written to the child welfare people in San Francisco, she supposed he might have given her name as Patricia, but wouldn't any resulting record search have come up blank? Yes, of course. Not even the address would correlate, because the one she'd printed in the space for address of last residence all those years ago had been her parents' address, and that was on the other side of town. Suppose Alan gave them both names, Polly and Patricia. Suppose he had. She knew enough about the workings of government bureaucracies to believe it didn't matter what name or names Alan had given them. When writing to her, the letter would have come to the name and address they had on file. Polly had a friend in Oxford whose correspondence from the University of Maine still came addressed to her maiden name, although she had been married for 20 years. But this envelope had come addressed to Patricia Chalmers, not Polly Chalmers. And who in Castle Rock had called her Patricia just today? The same person who had known that Nettie Cobb was really Natisha Cobb, her good friend Leland Gaunt. All of that about the names is interesting, Aunt Evie said suddenly, but it ain't really the important thing. The important thing is the man, your man. He is your man, ain't he? Even now. You know he would never go behind your back like that letter said he done. Don't matter what name was on it or how convincing it might sound. You know that, don't you? Yes, she whispered. I know him. Had she really believed any of it? Or had she put her doubts about that absurd, unbelievable letter aside because she was afraid, in terror, actually, that Alan would see the nasty truth of the Oscar and force her to make a choice between him and it? Oh, no, that's too simple, she whispered. You believed it, all right. Only for half a day, but you did believe it. Oh, Jesus, what have I done? She tossed the crumpled letter onto the floor with the revolted expression of a woman who has just realized she's holding a dead rat. I didn't tell him what I was angry about, didn't give him a chance to explain, just believed it. Why? In God's name, why? She knew, of course, it had been the sudden, shameful fear that her lies about the cause of Kelton's death had been discovered, the misery of her years in San Francisco suspected, her culpability in the death of her baby being evaluated, and all this by the one man in the world whose good opinion she wanted and needed. But that wasn't all of it. That wasn't even most of it. Mostly it had been pride, wounded, outraged, throbbing, swollen, malignant pride. Pride, the coin without which her purse would be entirely empty. She had believed because she had been in a panic of shame, a shame which had been born of pride. I have always so enjoyed ladies who take pride in themselves. A terrible wave of pain broke in her hands. Polly moaned and held them against her breasts. "Not too late, Polly," Mr. Gaunt said softly. "Not too late, even now."
"Oh, fuck pride!"
Polly shrieked suddenly into the dark of her closed, stuffy bedroom and ripped the Oscar from her neck. She held it high overhead in her clenched fist, the fine silver chain whipping wildly, and she felt the surface of the charm crack like the shell of an egg inside her hand.
"Fuck pride!"
Pain instantly clawed its way into her hands like some small and hungry animal. But she knew even then that the pain was not as great as she had feared, nowhere near as great as she had feared. She knew it as surely as she knew that Alan had never written to Child Welfare in San Francisco, asking about her.
"Fuck pride! Fuck it! Fuck it! Fuck it!"
she screamed, and threw the Oscar across the room. It hit the wall, bounced to the floor, and split open. Lightning flashed, and she saw two hairy legs poke out through the crack. The crack widened, and what crawled out was a small spider. It scuttered toward the bathroom. Lightning flashed again, printing its elongated, ovate shadow on the floor like an electric tattoo. Polly leaped from her bed and chased after it. She had to kill it, and quickly, because even as she watched, the spider was swelling. It had been feeding on the poison it had sucked out of her body, and now that it was free of its containment, there was no telling how big it might grow. She slapped the bathroom light switch, and the fluorescent over the sink flickered into life. She saw the spider scurrying toward the tub. When it went through the door, it had been no bigger than a beetle. Now it was the size of a mouse. As she came in, it turned and scurried toward her, that horrid clittering sound of its legs beating against the tiles. And she had time to think, it was between my breasts. It was lying against me. It was lying against me all the time. Its body was a bristly blackish brown. Tiny hairs stood out on its legs. Eyes as dull as fake ruby stared at her. And she saw that two fangs stuck out of its mouth like curved vampire teeth. They were dripping some clear liquid. Where the droplets struck the tiles, they left small, smoking craters. Polly screamed and grabbed the bathroom plunger, which stood beside the toilet. Her hands screamed back at her, but she closed them about the plunger's wooden handle just the same and struck the spider with it. It retreated, one of its legs now broken and hanging uselessly askew. Polly chased after it as it ran for the tub. Hurt or not, it was still growing. Now it was the size of a rat. Its bulging belly had dragged against the tiles, but it went up the shower curtain with weird agility. Its legs made a sound against the plastic like tiny spats of water. The rings jingled on the steel bar running overhead. Polly swung the plunger like a baseball bat, the heavy rubber cup whooshing through the air, and struck the horrid thing again. The rubber cup covered a lot of area, but was not, unfortunately, very effective when it connected. The shower curtain billowed inward, and the spider dropped off into the tub with a meaty plop. In that instant, the light went out. Polly stood in the dark, the plunger in her hand, and listened to the spider scurrying. Then the lightning flashed again, and she could see its humped, bristly back protruding over the lip of the tub. The thing which had come out of the thimble-sized Oscar was as big as a cat now. The thing which had been nourishing itself on her heart's blood, even as it abstracted the pain from her hands. The envelope I left out at the old Camber place, what was that? With the Oscar no longer around her neck, with the pain awake and yelling in her hands, she could no longer tell herself it had nothing to do with Alan. The spider's fangs clicked on the porcelain edge of the tub. It sounded like someone clicking a penny deliberately on a hard surface for attention. Its listless doll's eyes now regarded her over the lip of the tub. "It's too late," those eyes seemed to say. "Too late for Alan. Too late for you. Too late for everyone." Polly launched herself at it.
"What did you make me do?"
she screamed. What did you make me do? Oh, you monster, what did you make me do? And the spider rose up on its rear legs, pawing obscenely at the shower curtain for balance with its front ones to meet her attack. Ace Merrill began to respect the old dude a little when Keaton produced a key which opened the locked shed with the red diamond-shaped high-explosive signs on the door. He began to respect him a little more when he felt the chilly air, heard the steady low whoosh of the air conditioner, and saw the stacked crates. Commercial dynamite. Lots of commercial dynamite. It wasn't quite the same thing as having an arsenal filled with Stinger missiles, but it was close enough for rock and roll. My, yes. There had been a powerful 8-cell flashlight in the carry compartment between the van's front seats, along with a supply of other useful tools, and now, as Alan neared Castle Rock in his station wagon, as Norris Ridgwick sat in his kitchen fashioning a hangman's noose with a length of stout hemp rope, as Polly Chalmers' dream of Aunt Evie moved toward its conclusion, Ace ran the flashlight's bright spotlight from one crate to the next. Overhead, the rain drummed on the shed's roof. It was coming down so hard that Ace could almost believe he was back in the prison showers. "Let's get on with it," Buster said in a low, hoarse voice. "Just a minute, Dad," Ace said. "It's break time." He handed Buster the flashlight and took out the plastic bag Mr. Gaunt had given him. He tipped a little pile of coke into the snuff hollow on his left hand and snorted it quickly. "What's that?" Buster asked suspiciously. "South American bingo dust, and it's just as tasty as taters." "Ha!" Keaton snorted. "Cocaine. They sell cocaine." Ace didn't have to ask who they were. The old dude had talked about nothing else on the ride up here, and Ace suspected he would talk about nothing else all night. "Not true, Dad," Ace said. "They don't sell it. They're the ones who want it all to themselves." He tipped a little more into the snuff hollow at the base of his thumb and held his hand out. "Try it and tell me I'm wrong." Keaton looked at him with a mixture of doubt, curiosity, and suspicion. "Why do you keep calling me Dad? I'm not old enough to be your dad." "Well, I doubt if you ever read the underground comics, but there's this guy named R. Crum," Ace said. The coke was at work in him now, sparking all his nerve endings alight. "He does these comics about a guy named Zippy, and to me, you look just like Zippy's dad." "Is that good?" Buster asked suspiciously. "Awesome," Ace assured him. "But I'll call you Mr. Keaton if you want." He paused and then added deliberately, "Just like they do." "No," Buster said at once. "That's all right, as long as it's not an insult." "Absolutely not," Ace said. "Go on, try it. A little of this shit and you'll be singing hi-ho, hi-ho, it's off to work we go until the break of dawn." Buster gave him another look of dark suspicion, then snorted the coke Ace had offered. He coughed, sneezed, then clapped a hand to his nose. His watering eye stared balefully at Ace. "It burns!" "Only the first time," Ace assured him happily. "Anyway, I don't feel a thing. Let's stop fooling around and get this dynamite into the van." "You bet, Dad." It took them less than 10 minutes to load the crates of dynamite. After they had put the last one in, Buster said, "Maybe that stuff of yours does do something after all. Can I have a little more?" "Sure, Dad," Ace grinned. "I'll join you." They tooted up and headed back to town. Buster drove, and now he began to look not like Zippy's dad, but Mr. Toad in Walt Disney's The Wind in the Willows. A new, frantic light had come into the head selectman's eyes. It was amazing how fast the confusion had dropped out of his mind. He felt he could now understand everything they had been up to, every plan, every plot, every machination. He told Ace all about it as Ace sat in the back of the van with his legs crossed, hooking up hot point timers to blasting caps. For the time being, at least, Buster had forgotten all about Alan Pangborn, who was their ringleader. He was entranced by the idea of blowing Castle Rock, or as much of it as possible, to Kingdom Come. Ace's respect became solid admiration. The old fuck was crazy, and Ace liked crazy people, always had. He felt at home with them. And, like most people on their first cocaine high, old Dad's mind was touring the outer planets. He couldn't shut up. All Ace had to do was keep saying, "Uh-huh," and, "That's right, Dad," and, "Fucking A, Dad." Several times, he almost called Keaton Mr. Toad instead of Dad, but caught himself. Calling this guy Mr. Toad might be a very bad idea. They crossed the tin bridge while Alan was still 3 miles from it and got out in the pouring rain. Ace found a blanket in one of the van's bench compartments and draped it over a bundle of dynamite and one of the cap-equipped timers. "Do you want help?" Buster asked nervously. "You better let me handle it, Dad. You'd be apt to fall in the goddamn stream, and I'd have to waste time fishing you out. Just keep your eyes open, okay?" "I will." "Ace, why don't we sniff a little more of that cocaine first?" "Not right now," Ace said indulgently and patted one of Buster's meaty arms. "This shit is almost pure. You want to explode?" "Not me," Buster said. "Everything else, but not me." He began to laugh wildly. Ace joined him. "Having some fun tonight, huh, Dad?" Buster was amazed to find this was true. His depression following Myrtle's accident now seemed years distant. He felt that he and his excellent friend Ace Merrill finally had them right where they wanted them, in the palm of their collective hand. "You bet," he said, and watched Ace slide down the wet, grassy bank beside the bridge with a blanket-wrapped parcel of dynamite held against his belly.